Gil and Susanna Wesley were people whom God used to raise two of the most significant leaders in the church's history. Charles, whose hymns we still sing, and John Wesley, who was the man who really God's man to bring about the great revival that transformed England at the end of the 18th century and instituted the Methodist Church and many other things that have flown from that. Susanna was a remarkable woman. There were all kinds of things about her that really were very special. But she wasn't a perfect model of a wife and mother. She and her husband Samuel were both stubborn, strong-minded, opinionated people. Samuel was a clergyman, and he was so difficult to deal with in the church that the parishioners would do things just to tell him that maybe he should change his style, like set his crops on fire or burn down his barn, which is a fairly emphatic way of saying maybe some changes are in order. He was strict, he was impatient, he was unpopular. Susanna was aggressive and determined, and they fought. They fought hard and strongly, and they fought about politics. Samuel was a great follower of King William, the William of Orange, who had been brought in a kind of turbulent period in English history. Susanna was a loyal follower of King James II, who'd been deposed and in exile, and they argued back and forth about which king they should follow. And it all came to a head one night when Samuel prayed, and he prayed for King William. And at the end of the prayer, Susanna refused to say amen. And immediately after they got up from prayer, Samuel fell down on the floor and prayed a curse before God upon him if he ever touched his wife again before she repented. He stood up, looked at her, and said, "We have two kings. From now on, we will have two beds." And he walked out of the house, got on his horse, and rode away. 12 months, no contact whatsoever between them. Now, I don't care how seriously you take Kathleen Brown or Pete Wilson. Please. But they got back together. King William fortunately died, at least fortunately for the Wesleys. So they got back together, and 10 months after the coming together, John arrived on the scene as God's gift to them for reconciliation. John was a marvelous preacher, and God used him, and he set off a revival, but he had a terrible marriage. I won't go into the whole story, but friends talk about walking into their house one day to their amazement to discover John, who was a little man, being dragged around the house by his hair, by his wife. Literally, she was pulling him through the house by his hair, sort of wiping the floor with him in a very literal sense. And finally, she left. And he wrote in his journal, "I have not left her. I have not sent her away. I will not recall her." And he underlined it several times. Now, not all marriages are quite that troubled. But I think we recognize that even if we say, "Have your own way, Lord," and then we come to live together with a man or a woman in marriage, we discover what conflict can be about. Oh, it doesn't have to be dramatic. I'm always reminded of that story that's told about two porcupines up in northern Canada. When the mercury drops and the snow begins to fly, they move together. They cuddle together for warmth, but the closer they get, their quills stick each other. So they move apart and they get cold, so they come together and they stick each other. Then they move apart and they spend their relationship drawing and distancing. And they're either going to freeze or they're going to poke each other to death if they don't learn to adjust. And our marriage relationships are a great deal like that. We all have quills. We all have places where we poke another person, feelings, behaviors, attitudes, manners, backgrounds. How we deal with our differences determines the health of our relationship. So this morning I want you to think with me about conflict. And I'd like to begin by looking at a case study. It's found back in 1 Kings, in the middle of the Old Testament, 1 Kings chapter 12. It isn't a story about marriage, it's a story about conflict. But in this case study of conflict, I think we can learn some things that relate very specifically to our marriage. It is about the son of the greatest king in terms of establishing the glory and grandeur of Israel that Israel ever had. That was King Solomon. David was the great king in terms of the warrior and the leader, but Solomon took it to the peak of its power. But after Solomon died, his son Rehoboam came to the throne. And when Rehoboam came to the throne, he had a nation that had so many things right about it. It had been the golden age of Israel. We read in verse 1 of 1 Kings chapter 12 that Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. So this is going to be his coronation time, and the special occasion in which he is going to take the scepter that his father had passed to him. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon. There had been some political stirrings under Solomon's era. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us." Now, lighten the harsh labor. That would be a forced labor, conscripted labor. And the heavy yoke, that's taxes, he put on us, and we'll serve him. Rehoboam answered, "Go away for 3 days, and then come back to me." So the people went away. Let me just set this with you for a bit. I've been fascinated by D-Day and all of the events that lead up to the 50th memorial that is going to take place tomorrow. I've been fascinated with D-Day for a long period of time. And there's something heroic. There's something tragic. I wiped away more than a few tears as I watched different parts of things that were on television over these last few days. But you can't help but wonder at the courage that was involved in that. I would love to be at Normandy. Several years ago, though, I was at Gettysburg. And I remember standing in Gettysburg up on the ridge, looking out towards Seminary Ridge, and just imagining all of people in that last charge coming across the way. And I didn't have the same feeling. There's heroism, there's grandeur, but there's something about a civil war. It's terribly sad and tragic. Family members often literally fighting one another. And there's a whole different sense, even though there's marvelous heroism in individual acts, a civil war is especially sad. But where we're going to go before we end chapter 12 is the civil war that ended Israel as a 12-tribe nation until the time Jesus Christ returns and reestablishes it. This is an event that occurred 1,000 years before Christ, and its effects still carry on. And it was related to the way Solomon, or Rehoboam rather, deals with this conflict, with this issue. Doesn't matter how wise the counsel you get is, if you don't pay attention to it, you're a fool. Rehoboam had received counsel from his father. The whole book of Proverbs is a father speaking to his son. It's Solomon, mainly, speaking to Rehoboam. He says things in it like, "Better is a patient man than a warrior. A man who conquers his temper is better than he who conquers a city." It said, "Starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam. So drop the matter before the dispute breaks out." Because once that dam is breached, the water's going to spill everywhere, and it's going to come with a rush that's going to be destructive. Don't let it start. But Rehoboam is a man of a different character. Now, in verses 1 to 5, let me just paint the background. We've got a legacy of the past. Rehoboam comes to the throne. As he comes to the throne, there's so much that's good about the nation. And Solomon's brought it to the golden age. But buried deep are old tribal resentments. They go back to David. They go back to King Saul. They go back to earlier kinds of issues. And they're all there under the surface. They've never really been resolved. Then there's the legacy that comes from Solomon himself. Solomon had had such a fixation on glory that he'd forced Israel under a burden of taxation, a heavy yoke he'd put on them, and forced labor. They were forced off the fields, off their own business, to work for him under the sword. And all of that is there. And then there's Rehoboam's own things that are going on in his own life. He's battling some inner issues that become clear in this passage. And you know, there's a lot like that in marriage. When a couple comes to marriage, they always bring a history. They bring a legacy of their parents and even their grandparents, things that have gone on in their life. There's a legacy from the past, things that have not been dealt with, things that are still in their own life, and then they join with another person. And it doesn't matter, as it were, who you follow in another person's life, there's always going to be quills that begin to stick each other. But the important thing is, in verse 5, or verse 4, the issue was resolvable. Just lighten the harsh labor, lighten the heavy yoke, we will serve you. We're willing to be involved in this. There was a tremendous opportunity here for Rehoboam to consolidate his power. The conflict was there. There was a genuine difference. Solomon had said, you must pay the taxes, you must go under this labor, and they come along and say, we don't want not to serve you, just lighten the load off us. Just take some of the pressure off. And this conflict, which is always true of conflict, was a tremendous opportunity. Just waiting for Rehoboam to grab hold of it. But I want you to notice from verse 6 to verse 15, he consistently chooses to fight to win. And whenever you approach the issue of conflict that I'm going to win, you begin to do the kind of things that Rehoboam does. The first thing that Rehoboam does as he begins this issue, and it's not said in the text, and that's the thing that's so significant about it. The first thing he does is he relies on himself. Now notice what it says in verse 6. It says, then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who'd served his father Solomon during his lifetime. How would you advise me to answer these people, he asked. They replied, if today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants. But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who'd grown up with him and were serving them. Now, we'll come back and pick this up. But what I want you to notice is what Rehoboam doesn't do. His father had been called to the throne and he had this responsibility, and the first thing he does is pray. Is go into the presence of God and say, Lord, if ever I've needed your wisdom, if ever I've needed your direction, if ever I've needed your counsel, please give it to me now. And the Lord is so pleased with Solomon's response, he says, I'll give you whatever you ask. And Solomon's response is, Lord, I don't want it for myself. I want it for my nation. Give me wisdom. But Rehoboam has nothing of that issue. Rehoboam doesn't think to approach God, and he's totally focused on what is best for him. When the elders come to him and says, be a servant to them, and they'll follow you all the days of their life, he's not interested in being a servant. He's interested in being served. He's self-centered, not servant-minded. He's focused on what's best for me, not what's best for the nation. And when I bring that mindset into my relationship to my wife, that how can I be served? How can I win? How can I get the most out of this? I can be sure that I'm going to escalate the problem. The issue is, will I be a servant, or am I going to insist on being served and winning? Now, the second thing that strikes me that's significant here is not only did he rely on himself, but he refused to listen. He goes to the elders of the nation, they give him advice, and then he goes to the young men because he doesn't like the advice. He doesn't want somebody to tell him what is the wise way to go. He simply wants somebody to confirm his prejudices. He's focused on what he wants to see. He's stubborn and selfish, and he goes to the young men, and the young men give him the answer. You notice in verse 9, he asks them, what's your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, lighten the yoke your father put on us? Young men who'd grown up with him and knew him, they knew what he wanted to hear, and they answer according to what he wants to hear. He's totally unwilling to listen to the nation. Proverbs chapter 18, verse 2, it said this, a fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but delights in airing his own opinions. You ever met somebody like that? Rehoboam's not interested in understanding what the people are saying. He's only interested in giving his own opinion. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is a shame and a disgrace to him, Proverbs 18 also says. So he's not interested in listening. And many times in our relationships, I'm so concerned about loading my gun so I can fire back that I have no idea what you're saying to me. And so we talk right past each other. Rehoboam doesn't interest himself in listening, just in hearing what he wants to hear. Third thing he does, and notice in verse 8, and going back to that, is he totally rejects compromise. I've already mentioned this in effect, but his point is, all he can think of is win-lose. The only way I can get what I want is for you to lose. There's other ways in which we come to these kind of situations. Ray Kroc once said, the man who built McDonald's to what it was, if your competitor is drowning, put a hose in his mouth. And that's one way of approaching conflict. I'm going to win. And some of us have the gorilla built into us. That this is a test of wills. And any compromise is a defeat. Any negotiation is a commitment to back down. And in our marriage relationships, we bring that attitude in, and everything turns into a battle of, I'm right. I'm the person who is to be followed and listened to here. Some of us get into another mindset, and that's what I would call a lose-win. That I've got to lose so you can win. And the attitude is that this is a game, again, of win-lose. Others of us get into lose-lose. If I'm going to lose, you're going to lose. You know, you've all heard the story of the man who was reading the paper and he noticed a brand new Mercedes-Benz being advertised for $200. We were sure there was a mistake, but he got on the phone and phoned the woman or the person, and she answered the phone. It was a woman, and she said, no, it's true. If you come over, first person to come over gets it. And so he drove over to the house and saw the car. It was in beautiful condition, drove it around the block. He was mechanical enough to sense there's nothing wrong with this. Paid the woman the $200 and handed over the check. She wrote out a receipt, gave it back to him, gave him the keys. And just before he drove away, he said, ma'am, can you explain this? Well, she said, listen, my husband has run off with his secretary. And he wired me and said, sell the car and send me the money. You can keep the rest. So I'm just doing what he said. If I'm going to lose, you're going to lose. And often in our relationships, we work that way. Lose-lose relationships. And Rehoboam had no ability to think win-win. How can I maximize the results for the people? And their needs are legitimate and their concerns are real. And how can I maximize the results for myself? If he had thought win-win, the whole scenario would have looked differently. But all too often in our conflicts, we get into win-lose, lose-win, lose-lose. And we reject any sense of this is the line in the sand, I'm not going to budge, I'm not going to cross that. Fourth thing that's true about him as he approaches this issue, and beginning at verse 10, you can hear it. He chooses inflammatory language. As a matter of fact, even some of the things that are said here, let me read it to you. The young man who'd grown up with him said, tell these people who have said to you, my father put a heavy yoke on us, and make our yoke lighter. Tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. That's a polite translation, actually. He's talking not about his finger, but about his male part. And he's bragging about his macho, his chauvinism. And he uses this deliberate language to say, my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I'll make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions. 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. The king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy, I'll make it heavier. My father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions. Now, the point is this. The way we speak in conflict is absolutely crucial. His words were harsh. He's a man with blowtorch words. One of the great political leaders in England during the earlier part of the century, during World War I, was David Lloyd George. And he was an eloquent man. But he, over the course of time, alienated everyone. He began at the pinnacle of power, and then just sort of his career crumbled into nothingness. And one of his biographers makes this observation about David Lloyd George, and I quote, when angry, he became a fierce opponent, capable of cruel words and ruthless actions. I wound where I can hurt most. And you know, that's the trouble with marriage. I mean, I know the buttons I can push with Elizabeth. I know so much about her that I'm terribly dangerous if my tongue gets out of control. Because the words you say to her may not have nearly the same effect, but I know the words that will go right down into the depth of her heart and tear out her insides. And so do you about your partner. And we live in a society in which says, oh, it's bad to suppress anger. Let it out. Be honest. Now, suppression is not the answer, but letting it out is letting steam out of a scalding or scalding steam out on people, and it burns, and it scars, and it goes deep into the heart. And I don't think Israel ever forgot, the 10 tribes to the north, these words. I am going to treat you harshly and severely. His words were harsh, and his tone was harsh. And he escalated the conflict because he did not know how to control his own temper and his own speech. And then in verses 14 and 15, when it all comes down to the bottom, he just simply exploits his position. He forces a solution. He doesn't fix the problem. He uses power. He's not interested in persuasion. He's not interested in negotiation. And so we have in verse 15, the king did not listen to the people. Now, ultimately, this was under the sovereign hand of God. And God had a sovereign purpose in all of this, which does not excuse Jeroboam. But the Lord works often through the sinfulness of people. That's why the text says, this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah, the Shilonite. But the point is that Rehoboam has taken an opportunity of conflict, a very significant time in which there's a difference. There's nothing wrong with the difference. But the way in which he deals with the difference has escalated this. Focusing on himself. Not hearing. Not understanding. Not being sensitive. Rejecting any kind of win-win solution. Deaf to the people around him. Using harsh language. And then finally just saying, this is the way it's going to be. And so we read in verses 16 to 20, and we don't need to dwell on it at any great length. When all Israel saw the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what have we to do with David? That is, the Davidic king. Rehoboam was a descendant of David. What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel, that is, the 10 northern tribes. Look after your own house, O David. There ain't a king like you. So the Israelites went home. But as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. King Rehoboam sent Adoniram, who was in charge of the forced labor. All Israel stoned him to death. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. Rehoboam, on one level, could say, I won the battle. I mean, I told them, I'm not going to reduce the taxes, I'm not going to reduce the forced labor, and he won. He made it very clear, but it's what's called a Pyrrhic victory. King Pyrrhus went into war against the Romans, and he won a battle. In the context, he so devastated his army that he was afraid to go into battle any longer. He said, if I win one more victory like that, I will be totally destroyed. So a Pyrrhic victory has been an apparent victory, which really is a loss. That's what Rehoboam's had. He's won the battle, but he's lost the union. He's lost the relationship. And from this point on, they're never going to be united. That's true in our marriages. I can win the battle, and I can choose to fight, but I can't choose the results. Listen to Proverbs chapter 18, verse 19. An offended brother is more unyielding than a fortified city, and disputes are like the barred gates of a citadel. An offended spouse is more unyielding than a fortified city. I win, I lose. issue had nothing to do with the conflict itself. It had nothing to do with taxation. It had nothing to do with forced labor. It had everything to do with the way in which that was dealt with and resolved. The kind of things we argue about in our marriages are irrelevant in large measure. What often happens is the grinding continuance of small, festering issues that are never dealt with and never put away. Just wears us down and wears us down and wears us down until finally there's a fortified city. And we can't enter that. Now, I'd like you to flip the coin and look at the other side. If there's destructive conflict, I think biblically there's constructive conflict. And I'd like you to turn with me over to Ephesians chapter 4. And we looked at Ephesians chapter 4 last week, and I just want to draw your attention to two verses as we notice that this is kind of the seedbed of a biblical understanding of communication. And in verse 26 and 27 of chapter 4, the Apostle Paul looks honestly at the issue of conflict. He says, "In your anger, do not sin." Or more literally, it translates, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. And do not give the devil a foothold." Let me suggest to you for a minute that you replace the word anger with the idea of conflict. Not all conflict engages anger. Conflict is simply a difference that we have about something. And the intensity of that difference is very significant. But there's something about just that basic understanding that we've got differences between us. And I want you to notice three things that seem to me to be true from this passage and generally biblically about how to have a fair fight, because there's going to be differences. And what happens when we do have differences? And I want to suggest to you that the things we need to do are choose our attitude, choose our goal, and choose our weapons. And if we do those things right, if we choose our attitude carefully, and we choose our goal wisely, and we choose our weapons fairly, then God is going to bring blessing. Let's think first of all about choosing our attitude wisely. It seems to me there's three things we need to say about conflict. The first is, conflict's inevitable in a relationship. Absolutely inevitable. It's inevitable because we're sinners. First rule of any home is that sinners live there. All we like sheep have gone in our own way. And when everybody's going in their own way, you're going to have some differences related to that. So conflict's inevitable because we're sinners. Conflict's inevitable because we're different. You look at any place where two rivers come together, and at the point at which they come together, there's always turbulence. At the point at which I share my life with my wife's life, there's always going to be some meshing and some turbulence at that, on all kinds of different levels. Conflict is inevitable because we're changing. And as you live your married life longer, conflict doesn't go away because there's continued issues that come up. Now, the way in which you learn to resolve that determine whether or not your relationship is healthy or not, but conflict's inevitable. Conflict's also very revealing. Conflict is one of those places that tells me an enormous amount about who I am. What I get angry about reveals an enormous amount about me. I get angry about a scratch on my car, it tells me what my value of my possessions is. If I get angry because somebody cuts me on the freeway, if I get angry because I see injustice, if I get angry, what I get angry about tells me a lot about myself. What I get annoyed about in my relationship to my wife is very revealing about who I am. That's why somebody said marriage is the most expensive way to discover your own faults. I mean, marriage is a mirror that I'm like that. Because I see myself more clearly in my relationship to my partner, that most intimate person, than anywhere else. And what we're conflicting about tells me an enormous amount about who I really am. And because of that, conflict's important. It's kind of like that red light that comes on the dash. And it begins to glow red, and I could ignore it, or I can stop and get it dealt with. I can pay now or I can pay later. And conflict, when we have differences, begins to be a place like that. If I avoid conflict, if I look at that red light and I say, well, I'm just going to pull away from that. I shrink the area of our growth and our sharing and our intimacy into a smaller and smaller circle. If I don't deal with areas of conflict, we'll never grow through it, or we'll retreat from it, and we'll just say, that's an area we don't talk about. That's an area we don't deal with. And the area of our relationship will be a smaller and smaller circle. But conflict's the door to vulnerability. Conflict's the door to intimacy. Conflict's the door to growth. And I need to choose my attitude to conflict to say, it is not wrong to have anger. It is not wrong to have difference. It is not wrong to have irritation. But it is always wrong to be sinful in the way in which I deal with it. I'm struck by the fact, I read two studies recently, and you can do with these what you want. One is a book by John Gottman, who is a psychologist up at the University of Washington, who's written a book, Why Marriages Succeed or Fail. And he points out there's different styles of conflict. There's conflict avoidance, couples who just kind of back away from that. There's conflict, there's people who validate conflict and work through it. And there's volatile conflict, where couples really go at it. And he makes a fascinating observation, having studied conflict. He says, you know, the style of conflict resolution is not nearly as important as one simple magic formula. And the formula he suggests is this. If there is a 5-to-1 ratio in your marriage between positive input and blessing and encouragement and affirmation to conflict and difference, you're going to do well. But if it's less than that, you're headed for serious trouble. Another study David Myers talks about in a book called The Pursuit of Happiness. They monitored, I think, 1,000 couples for the number of arguments they had and the number of sexual relationships they had. And they asked them to monitor it personally, and they came up with this interesting observation that virtually every couple that had sexual relations more often than they had arguments wrote down that they were very happy. But no couple that had arguments more than they had sexual relationships said that they were happy. Now, there's all kinds of other factors you can figure out. Why are they having sexual relationships? Why aren't they having them? But nevertheless, the point is that it's not simply the presence of conflict, but the context of conflict that becomes significant. That's why the second thing is important. If I need to choose my attitude to conflict wisely, I need to carefully, I need to choose my goal wisely. What is the goal? Is my goal like Rehoboam? I'm going to win at all costs. Or is my attitude going to be, I'm going to keep the peace at all costs? I love the story Chuck Swindoll told of some GIs over in Korea. And they were living off base. They had a home of their own, and they had a Korean houseboy looking after things, and they treated them terribly. I mean, these were young guys in their 20s, and they just did everything they could to this kid. They would nail his shoes to the floor. They would put buckets of water over the doors. They would grease the handles on the pots on the stove so when he picked it up, they'd slide out and get all over everything. He just did thing out. And he was always cheerful, and he was always happy, and he was always positive. Finally, they were really embarrassed, and they came to him and said, we're so sorry. I mean, your attitude has just embarrassed us and shamed us. We won't do those things anymore. So he said, no more nail shoes to the floor? No, no. No more pots over our door? No. No more grease on hand? No, no more. Ah, then me no more spit in soup? And the reason we laugh is we all know what it's like to spit in the soup in terms of, you know, interpersonal relationships a little bit. We look like we're dealing with this really nicely. We come on Sunday morning and we've just had a battle royal the whole way, and then magic occurs when we hit the church parking lot. How are you doing this morning? Oh, isn't it a wonderful day in the Lord? And you're hoping none of the kids say what you just said in the car before you were... The issue is that we need to be sure, biblically, that our goal is to win the peace, not the war. To so relate to our partner that there will be a union and a drawing together. That's why this verse has become so important to me. When it says in verse 26, don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. Don't give the devil a foothold. I believe with all of my heart that Satan is looking in our marriages to try and get a foothold. I deeply believe Satan is attacking as never before marriage relationships. And the word foothold is exactly the same word that was used about Omaha Beach, a beachhead. And Satan wants to get a beachhead into our marriage relationship, and if he gets a beachhead, he's going to assault right through that point. And unresolved conflict is the beachhead Satan uses. And every time there's an unresolved conflict in our relationship, you need to feel the Normandy landing's just taken place. And if we don't deal with this, there's going to be an invasion front and all kinds of things are going to go down. He says, don't let the sun go down in your wrath. I remember lying in bed the first year we were married, saying to the Lord, with my back to Elizabeth at that point, I'm not going to say I'm sorry this time. Wasn't my fault this time. Of course, in my self-righteousness, it never was. But I always say I'm sorry, which probably meant one of the last 20 times I'd said I'm sorry. And I remember lying there, and all of a sudden, the Lord brought this verse to mind. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Now, I've been brought up in the King James, so I remembered it in the King James. And I remember very self-righteously lying there thinking, I'm not wrathful, Lord. I'm irritated, but I'm not wrathful. And then I remembered, because I just studied that verse in my Greek New Testament, the Greek word is irritation. Don't let the sun go down on your irritation. And I knew there, lying in bed that night, I had a choice. I could be right, or we could be right, but the two couldn't be the same. I either had to choose to say, God's word is going to control my behavior, and irritation is going to be dealt with before we go to sleep, or I'm going to give Satan a beachhead. I can remember vividly feeling that at that point. And by God's grace, rolling over and probably meeting Elizabeth doing the same thing, because she's always been a much better conflict resolver than I have. And we set as an issue in our relationship at that point, we will not go to bed with unresolved issues between us. Doesn't mean we can always get the answer. It does mean we can defuse the emotion out of it. Now, I don't want you to be confused. A few late nights over the years. But it's marvelous to begin to wake up day after day with saying, there isn't festering issues here. There's no Satan's beachhead. Well, I've got to go quickly here. Seems I always say that every Sunday morning. But the last thing I want you to notice is this. We need to choose our weapons fairly. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your irritation. Don't give the devil a foothold. Choose your weapons carefully. First, attack the problem, not the person. It's been very helpful to me, and I've seen it so often in marriage, to say to people, where you put the problem is the crucial thing. See, the natural thing is when something comes up in our marriage, let's suppose this is it. The natural thing is to put it between us. And when it's between us, I pretend I'm talking about the problem, but I really start attacking you. You always, you never. But there's a whole lot of difference in taking the same problem and the two of us standing here and saying, we've got a problem out there. We've got a problem. How are we going to solve the problem? So we stand side by side to say, in effect, our relationship's not at question here. If there's no usness question here, how are we going to deal with this? And if our focus is on solving the problem, it means we say it clearly. What's the issue? We hear it carefully, but we attack the problem, not the person. Second rule is, fix the problem, not the blame. All kinds of issues come up, and the whole thing that we want to do is fix the blame. Who's responsible for this? Great verse in Matthew chapter 7 that warns us, don't be doing speck removal from your brother's eye until you've dealt with beams in your own eye. And if I'm concerned about fixing the blame, all I'm doing is speck inspection. But I've got the beam in my own eye. I need to focus on the solution. I need to focus on the answer, not the mistake. And as I've already said, that ventilation fad that says, be angry and let it all out, only scalds people around me. Carol Tavris has written a fascinating book, Anger, the Misunderstood Emotion, in which she makes the point that the idea that anger should just be let out does not resolve the problem of anger. It only makes people angrier. Anger is never an excuse for sin. And fixing the problem, not the blame, means that we keep it private, not public. We don't enlist friends. We don't enlist family. We don't begin to enlist others to go around and say, I'm right. We're concerned about resolving the problem. That doesn't mean we avoid counsel. It does mean we're careful about the counsel we get. Third issue, or third rule, is do it now, not later. Do it now, not later. I'm convinced of this. If you don't resolve problems, not only have you given Satan a beachhead, but you bring to bear free-floating irritation in a relationship. I find this sometimes happens. I get all bent out of shape about something, and I think back and say, what in the world is bothering me about that? It's not nearly that important. I remember a couple coming in, or a fellow came in, and he sat down. We talked for a while. And he said, Gary, my marriage is in really trouble. And he said, what? What would tell me about it? You know, and he said, well, it's the toilet seat. Well, you're supposed to be shocked. But I said, toilet seat. Tell me about the toilet seat. Well, he said, she really wants it left down. And I leave it up sometimes. Sound familiar to any of you? But he said, that's not the problem. The problem is that we have a marriage, kind of curious living thing. We share bathroom facilities where we're living in a basement suite. There's another couple in this apartment. There's us in this one. We share a common bathroom. And she not only wants me to make sure I leave it down, but she wants me to make sure whenever she hears them use it that I go in and check that they've left it down. And I looked at him with my brilliant analytical mind, and I said, I know what you should do. You should go out and buy two of those toilet seat covers. Not just one, two. It'll be so heavy that that sucker will fall down all the time, and it won't stay up. And he looked at me with the kind of pathetic look of, I took time to come in to hear this information. And he said to me, it's not the toilet seat at all. He said, you know what I feel like? I feel like we've got a closet, and we've had problems in our relationship. And she doesn't talk to me for 5 days. And then we begin to talk, and we did something else. I don't talk, and then we begin to talk, but we never talk about what we got irritated about. And I feel I've got a large closet in our home in which we've thrown all of these problems. And now I'm afraid if I open the door and put the toilet seat in, all of the rest of that stuff's going to fall out. I remember I told that story in a premarital counseling thing to one guy, and he looked at me and said, you got to be kidding. I said, no, that's what he said. No, he said, you got to be kidding. Toilet seats were a big issue in my first two divorces. Well, so beware of the toilet seat. But what I want you to notice is unresolved problems don't go away. They turn into ghosts that come around and haunt. And unresolved conflicts become free-floating irritations that just seize for a symbol, and then that symbol gets blown out of all proportion. Fourth rule, if I can talk about choosing weapons carefully, attack the problem, not the person. Fix the problem, not the blame. Do it now, not later. Pray it up when you bring it up. That it's in a context of love, and it's a context of prayer, that we are going to be angry with one another and not sin. And if we don't do that, then we're going to launch a civil war. Conflicts are inevitable. Any couple that tells you, we've never had conflicts in our marriages, are either brain dead or lying. The conflicts are inevitable. The intensity of the conflict is a totally different issue. Conflicts are there. Effective marriages have good conflict resolvers. People who are committed to fight to a better end and not to a bitter end. Who are committed to see this as an opportunity for us to know one another, get this behind us, and move forward in our relationship to the glory of God. Some of us, if the truth be known, are very close to Rehoboam in 1 Kings chapter 12. We have gotten our relationship right at the verge of verse 16 where it says, what have we got to do with you, David? We can go off on our own. And as we close this morning, the question that the leaders said to Rehoboam was, if you will be their servant, they'll follow you forever. My question is, are you a servant or a winner? Because if your goal is to win rather than serve, you're going to lose. Would you bow with me? Father, I pray that as we think about issues in our relationships that exist between us, you would cause us not to have the heart of a Rehoboam, but the heart of the Lord Jesus. Pray that you would help us to be bridge builders, feet washers, servants, servants.